Section number 17 of Emile. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Naomi Brewster, Melbourne, Australia. Emile by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Translated by Barbara Foxley. Book number 3, part 3. I remember how once I tried to give a child a taste for chemistry. After showing him several metallic precipitates, I explained how ink was made. I told him how its blackness was merely the result of fine particles of iron separated from the vitriol and precipitated by an alkaline solution. In the midst of my learned explanation, the little rascal pulled me up short with the question I myself had taught him. I was greatly puzzled. After a few moments' thought, I decided what to do. I sent for some wine from the cellar of our landlord, and some very cheap wine from a wine merchant. I took a small flask of alkaline solution, and placed two glasses before me filled with two sorts of wine. Footnote. Before giving any explanation to a child, a little bit of apparatus serves to fix his attention. End of footnote. I said, "Food and drink are adulterated to make them seem better than they really are. These adulterations deceive both the eye and the palate, but they are unwholesome and make the adulterated article even worse than before, in spite of its fine appearance. All sorts of drinks are adulterated, and wine more than others, for the fraud is much more difficult to detect and more profitable to the fraudulent person. Sour wine is adulterated with litharge. Litharge is a preparation of lead. Lead, in combination with acids, forms a sweet salt which corrects the harsh taste of the sour wine, but it is poisonous. So, before we drink wine of doubtful quality, we should be able to tell if there is any lead in it. This is how I should do it. Wine contains not merely an inflammable spirit, as you have seen from the brandy made from it. It also contains an acid, as you know from the vinegar made from it. This acid has an affinity for metals. It combines with them and forms salts, such as iron rust, which is only iron dissolved by the acid in air or water, or such as verdigris, which is only copper dissolved in vinegar. But this acid has a still greater affinity for alkali than for metals, so that when we add alkali to the above-mentioned salts, the acid sets free the metal with which it had combined and combines with the alkali. Then the metal, set free from the acid which held it in solution, is precipitated and the liquid becomes opaque. If, then, there is litharge in either of these glasses of wine, the acid holds the litharge in solution. When I pour into it an alkaline solution, the acid will be forced to set the lead free in order to combine with the alkali. The lead, no longer held in solution, will reappear. The liquid will become thick, and after a time the lead will be deposited at the bottom of the glass. If there is no lead, nor any other metal in the wine, the alkali will slowly combine with the acid, all will remain clear, and there will be no precipitate. Footnote. The wine sold by retail dealers in Paris is rarely free from lead, though some of it does not contain litharge, for the counters are covered with lead, and when the wine is poured into the measures, and some of it spilt upon the counter, and the measures left standing on the counter, some of the lead is always dissolved. It is strange that so obvious and dangerous an abuse should be tolerated by the police. But indeed, well-to-do people who rarely drink these wines are not likely to be poisoned by them. End of footnote. Footnote. The vegetable acid is very gentle in its action. If it were a mineral acid, and less diluted, the combination would not take place without effervescence. End of footnote. Then I poured my alkaline solution first into one glass and then into the other. The wine from our own house remained clear and unclouded. The other at once became turbid, and an hour later the lead might be plainly seen precipitated at the bottom of the glass. This, I said, is a pure natural wine and fit to drink. The other is adulterated and poisonous. You wanted to know the use of knowing how to make ink. If you can make ink, you can find out what wines are adulterated. I was very well pleased with my illustration, but I found it made little impression on my pupil. When I had time to think about it, I saw that I had been a fool, for not only was it impossible for a child of 12 to follow my explanations, but the usefulness of the experiment did not appeal to him. He had tasted both glasses of wine and found them both good, so he attached no meaning to the word adulterated, which I thought I had explained so nicely. Indeed, the other words, unwholesome and poison, had no meaning whatever for him. He was in the same condition as the boy who told the story of Philip and his doctor. It is the condition of all children. The relation of causes and effects, whose connection is unknown to us, good and ill, of which we have no idea, the needs we have never felt, have no existence for us. It is impossible to interest ourselves in them sufficiently to make us do anything connected with them. At 15, we become aware of the happiness of a good man, as at 30, we become aware of the glory of paradise. If we had no clear idea of either, we should make no effort for their attainment, and even if we had a clear idea of them, we should make little or no effort unless we desired them and unless we felt we were made for them. It is easy to convince a child that what you wish to teach him is useful, but it is useless to convince if you cannot also persuade. Pure reason may lead us to approve or censure, but it is feeling which leads to action, and how shall we care about that which does not concern us? Never show a child what he cannot see. Since mankind is almost unknown to him, and since you cannot make a man of him, bring the man down to the level of the child. While you are thinking what will be useful to him when he is older, talk to him of what he knows he can use now. Moreover, as soon as he begins to reason, let there be no comparison with other children, no rivalry, no competition, not even in running races. I would far rather he did not learn anything than have him learn it through jealousy or self-conceit. Year by year, I shall just note the progress he has made. I shall compare the results with those of the following year. I shall say, you have grown so much. That is the ditch you jumped, the weight you carried, the distance you flung a pebble, the race you ran without stopping to take a breath, etc. Let us see what you can do now. In this way, he is stimulated to further effort without jealousy. He wants to excel himself as he ought to do. I see no reason why he should not emulate his own performances. I hate books. They only teach us to talk about things we know nothing about. Hermes, they say, engraved the elements of sciences on pillars, lest a deluge should destroy them. Had he imprinted them on men's hearts, they would have been preserved by tradition. Well-trained minds are the pillars on which human knowledge is most deeply engraved. Is there no way of correlating so many lessons scattered through so many books? No way of focusing them on some common object? Easy to see, interesting to follow, and stimulating even to a child? Could we but discover a state in which all men's needs appear in such a way as to appeal to the child's mind? a state in which the ways of providing for these needs are as easily developed. The simple and stirring portrayal of this state should form the earliest training of the child's imagination. Eager philosopher, I see your own imagination at work. Spare yourself the trouble. This state is already known. It is described with due respect to you, but far better than you could describe it, at least with greater truth and simplicity. Since we must have books, there is one book which, to my thinking, supplies the best treatise on an education according to nature. This is the first book Emile will read. For a long time, it will form his whole library. It will always retain an honored place. It will be the text to which all our talks about natural science are but the commentary. It will serve to test our progress towards a right judgment, and it will always be read with delight, so long as our taste is unspoilt. What is this wonderful book? Is it Aristotle, Pliny, Buffon? No, it is Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe on his island, deprived of the help of his fellow men, without the means of carrying on the various arts, yet finding food, preserving his life, and procuring a certain amount of comfort. This is a thing to interest people of all ages, and it can be made attractive to children in all sorts of ways. We shall thus make a reality of that desert island, which formerly served as an illustration. The condition, I confess, is not that of a social being, nor is it in all probabilities Emile's own condition, but he should use it as a standard of comparison for all other conditions. The surest way to raise him above prejudice and to base his judgments on the true relations of things is to put him in the place of a solitary man, and to judge all things as they would be judged by such a man in relation to their own utility. This novel, stripped of irrelevant matter, begins with Robinson's shipwreck on his island, and ends with the coming of the ship which bears him from it. And it will furnish Emile with material both for work and play during the whole period we are considering. His head should be full of it. He should always be busy with his castle, his goats, his plantations. Let him learn in detail, not from books but from things, all that is necessary in such a case. Let him think he is Robinson himself. Let him see himself clad in skins, wearing a tall cap, a great cutlass, all the grotesque get-up of Robinson Crusoe, even to the umbrella which he will scarcely need. He should anxiously consider what steps to take. Will this or that be wanting? He should examine his hero's conduct. Has he omitted nothing? Is there nothing he could have done better? He should carefully note his mistakes so as not to fall into them himself in similar circumstances. For you may be sure he will plan out just such a settlement for himself. This is a genuine castle in the air of this happy age, when the child knows no other happiness but food and freedom. What a motive will this infatuation supply in the hands of a skilful teacher who has aroused it for the purpose of using it? The child who wants to build a storehouse on his desert island will be more eager to learn than the master to teach. He will want to know all sorts of useful things and nothing else. You will need the curb as well as the spur. Make haste, therefore, to establish him on his island while this is all he needs to make him happy. For the day is at hand when, if he must still live on his island, he will not be content to live alone, when even the companionship of Man Friday, who is almost disregarded now, will not long suffice. The exercise of the natural arts, which may be carried on by one man alone, leads on to the industrial arts, which call for the cooperation of many hands. The former may be carried on by hermits, by savages, but the others can only arise in a society, and they make society necessary. So long as only bodily needs are recognized, man is self-sufficing. With superfluity comes the need for division and distribution of labor, for though one man working alone can earn a man's living, 100 men working together can earn the living of 200. As soon as some men are idle, others must work to make up for their idleness. Your main object should be to keep out of your scholar's way all idea of such social relations as he cannot understand. But when the development of knowledge compels you to show him the mutual dependence of mankind, instead of showing him its moral side, turn all his attention at first towards industry and the mechanical arts which make men useful to one another. While you take him from one workshop to another, let him try his hand at every trade you show him, and do not leave him alone till he has thoroughly learnt why everything is done, or at least everything that has attracted his attention. With this aim, you should take a share in his work and set him an example. Be yourself the apprentice that he may become the master. You may expect him to learn more in 1 hour's work than he should retain after a whole day's explanation. The value set by the general public on the various arts is in inverse ratio to their real utility. They are even valued directly according to their uselessness. This might be expected. The most useful arts are the worst paid, for the number of workmen is regulated by the demand, and the work which everybody requires must necessarily be paid at a rate which puts it within the reach of the poor. On the other hand, those great people who are called artists, not artisans, who labour only for the rich and idle, put a fancy price on their trifles. And as the real value of this vain labour is purely imaginary, the price itself adds to their market value, and they are valued according to their costliness. The rich think so much of these things, not because they are useful, but because they are beyond the reach of the poor. Nolo habere bona, nisi quibus populus inviderit. What will become of your pupils if you let them acquire this foolish prejudice, if you share it yourself? If, for instance, they see you show more politeness in a jeweller's shop than in a locksmith's, what idea will they form of the true worth of the arts and the real value of things when they see, on the one hand, a fancy price, and on the other, the price of real utility, and that the more a thing costs, the less it is worth? As soon as you let them get hold of these ideas, you may give up all attempt at further education. In spite of you, they will be like all the other scholars. You have wasted 14 years. Emile, bent on furnishing his island, will look at things from another point of view. Robinson would have thought more of a toolmaker's shop than all Said's trifles put together. He would have reckoned the toolmaker a very worthy man, and Said little more than a charlatan. My son will have to take the world as he finds it. He will not live among the wise, but among fools. He must therefore be acquainted with their follies, since they must be led by this means. A real knowledge of things may be a good thing in itself, but the knowledge of men and their opinions is better, for in human society man is the chief tool of man. And the wisest man is he who best knows the use of this tool. What is the good of teaching children an imaginary system, just the opposite of the established order of things among which they will have to live? First teach them wisdom, then show them the follies of mankind. These are the specious maxims by which fathers, who mistake them for prudence, strive to make their children the slaves of the prejudices in which they are educated, and the puppets of the senseless crowd, which they hope to make subservient to their passions. How much must be known before we attain a knowledge of man? This is the final study of the philosopher, and you expect to make it the first lesson of the child? Before teaching him our sentiments, first teach him to judge of their worth. Do you perceive folly when you mistake it for wisdom? To be wise, we must discern between good and evil. How can your child know men when he can neither judge of their judgments nor unravel their mistakes? It is a misfortune to know what they think without knowing whether their thoughts are true or false. First teach him things as they really are. Afterwards you will teach him how they appear to us. He will then be able to make a comparison between popular ideas and truth, and be able to rise above the vulgar crowd. For you are unaware of the prejudices you adopt, and you do not lead a nation when you are like it. But if you begin to teach the opinions of other people, before you teach how to judge of their worth, of one thing you may be sure, your pupil will adopt those opinions whatever you may do, and you will not succeed in uprooting them. I am therefore convinced that to make a young man judge rightly, you must form his judgment rather than teach him your own. So far, you see, I have not spoken to my pupil about men. He would have too much sense to listen to me. His relations to other people are as yet not sufficiently apparent to him to enable him to judge others by himself. The only person he knows is himself, and his knowledge of himself is very imperfect. But if he forms few opinions about others, those opinions are correct. He knows nothing of another's place, but he knows his own and keeps to it. I have bound him with the strong cord of necessity, instead of social laws, which are beyond his knowledge. He is still little more than a body. Let us treat him as such. Every substance in nature and every work of man must be judged in relation to his own use, his own safety, his own preservation, his own comfort. Thus he should value iron far more than gold, and glass than diamonds. In the same way, he has far more respect for a shoemaker or a mason than for a Lempereur, a Leblanc, or all the jewellers in Europe. In his eyes, a confectioner is really a great man, and he would give the whole Academy of Sciences for the smallest pastry cook in Lombard Street. Goldsmiths, engravers, gilders, embroiderers, he considers lazy people who play at great useless games. He does not even think much of a clockmaker. The happy child enjoys time without being a slave to it. He uses it, but he does not know its value. The freedom from passion, which makes every day alike to him, makes any means of measuring time unnecessary. When I assumed that Emile had a watch, just as I assumed that he cried, it was a commonplace Emile that I chose to serve my purpose and make myself understood. Footnote. When our hearts are abandoned to the sway of passion, then it is that we need a measure of time. The wise man's watch is his equable temper and his peaceful heart. He is always punctual, and he always knows the time. End of footnote. The real Emile, a child so different from the rest, would not serve as an illustration for anything. There is an order no less natural and even more accurate by which the arts are valued according to bounds of necessity which connect them. The highest class consists of the most independent, the lowest of those most dependent on others. This classification, which suggests important considerations on the order of society in general, is like the preceding one in that it is subject to the same inversion of popular estimation, so that the use of raw material is the work of the lowest and worst paid trades, while the oftener the material changes hands, the more the work rises in price and in honour. I do not ask whether industry is really greater and more deserving of reward when engaged in the delicate arts, which give the final shape to these materials, than in the labour which first gave them to man's use. But this I say, that in everything the art which is most generally useful and necessary is undoubtedly that which most deserves esteem, and that art which requires the least help from others is more worthy of honour than those which are dependent on other arts, since it is freer and more nearly independent. These are the true laws of value in the arts. All others are arbitrary and dependent on popular prejudice. Agriculture is the earliest and most honourable of arts. Metalwork I put next, then carpentry, and so on. This is the order in which the child would put them, if he has not been spoilt by vulgar prejudices. What valuable considerations Emile will derive from his Robinson in such matters! What will he think when he sees the arts only brought into perfection by subdivision, by the infinite multiplication of tools? He will say, "All these people are as silly as they are ingenious. One would think they were afraid to use their eyes and their hands. They invent so many tools instead. To carry on one trade, they become the slaves of many others. Every single workman needs a whole town. My friend and I shall gain skill. We only make tools we can take about with us. These people, who are so proud of their talents in Paris, would be no use at all on our island. They would have to become apprentices." Reader, do not stay to watch the bodily exercises and manual skill of our pupil, but consider the bent we are giving to his childish curiosity. Consider his common sense, his inventive spirit, his foresight. Consider what a head he will have on his shoulders. He will want to know about everything he sees or does, to learn the why and the wherefore of it. From tool to tool he will go back to the first beginning, taking nothing for granted. He will decline to learn anything that requires previous knowledge which he has not acquired. If he sees a spring, he will want to know how they got the steel from the mine. If he sees the pieces of a chest put together, he will want to know how the tree was cut down. When at work he will say of each tool, "If I had not got this, how could I make one like it, or how could I get along without it?" It is, however, difficult to avoid another error. When the master is very fond of a certain occupation, he is apt to assume that the child shares his tastes. Beware lest you are carried away by the interests of your work, while the child is bored by it, but is afraid to show it. The child must come first, and you must devote yourself entirely to him. Watch him, study him constantly, without his knowing it. Consider his feelings beforehand, and provide against those which are undesirable. Keep him occupied in such a way that he not only feels the usefulness of the thing, but takes a pleasure in understanding the purpose which his work will serve. The solidarity of the arts consists in the exchange of industry, that of commerce in the exchange of commodities, that of banks in the exchange of money or securities. All these ideas hang together, and their foundation has already been laid in early childhood with the help of Robert the Gardener. All we have now to do is to substitute general ideas for particular, and to enlarge these ideas by means of numerous examples, so as to make the child understand the game of business itself, brought home to him by means of particular instances of natural history with regard to the special products of each country, by particular instances of the arts and sciences which concern navigation and the difficulties of transport, greater or less in proportion to the distance between places, the position of land, seas, rivers, etc. There can be no society without exchange, no exchange without a common standard of measurement, no common standard of measurement without equality. Hence the first law of every society is some conventional equality, either in men or things. Conventional equality between men, a very different thing from natural equality, leads to the necessity for positive law, for example, government and kings. A child's political knowledge should be clear and restricted. He should know nothing of government in general beyond what concerns the right of property, of which he has already some idea. Conventional equality between things has led to the invention of money, for money is only one term in a comparison between the values of different sorts of things, and in this sense money is the real bond of society. But anything may be money. In former days it was cattle. Shells are used among many tribes at the present day. Sparta used iron, Sweden leather, while we use gold and silver. Metals, being easier to carry, have generally been chosen as the middle term of every exchange, and these metals have been made into coin to save the trouble of continual weighing and measuring, for the stamp on the coin is merely evidence that the coin is of a given weight, and the sole right of coining money is vested in the ruler because he alone has the right to demand the recognition of his authority by the whole nation. The stupidest people can perceive the use of money when it is explained in this way. It is difficult to make a direct comparison between various things, for instance, between cloth and corn, but when we find a common measure in money, it is easy for the manufacturer and the farmer to estimate the value of the goods they wish to exchange in terms of this common measure. If a given quantity of cloth is worth a given sum of money, and a given quantity of corn is worth the same sum of money, then the seller, receiving the corn in exchange for his cloth, makes a fair bargain. Thus, by means of money, it becomes possible to compare the value of goods of various kinds. Be content with this, and do not touch upon the moral effects of this institution. In everything, you must show clearly the use before the abuse. If you attempt to teach children how the sign has led to the neglect of the thing signified, how money is the source of all the false ideas of society, how countries rich in silver must be poor in everything else, you will be treating these children as philosophers, and not only as philosophers, but as wise men, for you are professing to teach them what very few philosophers have grasped. What a wealth of interesting objects towards which the curiosity of our pupil may be directed without ever quitting the real and material relations he can understand, and without permitting the formation of a single idea beyond his grasp. The teacher's art consists in this: to turn the child's attention from trivial details and to guide his thoughts continually towards relations of importance which he will one day need to know, that he may judge rightly of good and evil in human society. The teacher must be able to adapt the conversation with which he amuses his pupil to the turn already given to his mind. A problem which another child would never heed will torment Emile half a year. We are going to dine with wealthy people. When we get there, everything is ready for a feast. Many guests, many servants, many dishes, dainty and elegant china. There is something intoxicating in all these preparations for pleasure and festivity when you are not used to them. I see how they will affect my young pupil. While dinner is going on, while course follows course and conversation is loud around us, I whisper in his ear, "How many hands do you suppose the things on this table passed through before they got here?" What a crowd of ideas is called up by these few words. In a moment the mists of excitement have rolled away. He is thinking, considering, calculating, and anxious. The child is philosophizing, while philosophers, excited by wine or perhaps by female society, are babbling like children. If he asks questions, I decline to answer and put him off to another day. He becomes impatient, he forgets to eat and drink, he longs to get away from table and talk as he pleases. What an object of curiosity, what a text for instruction! Nothing has so far succeeded in corrupting his healthy reason. What will he think of luxury when he finds that every quarter of the globe has been ransacked, that some 2 million men have laboured for years, that many lives have perhaps been sacrificed, and all to furnish him with fine clothes to be worn at midday and laid in by the wardrobe at night? Be sure you observe what private conclusions he draws from all his observations. If you have watched him less carefully than I suppose, his thoughts may be tempted in another direction. He may consider himself a person of great importance in the world, when he sees so much labour concentrated on the preparation of his dinner. If you suspect his thoughts will take this direction, you can easily prevent it, or at any rate promptly efface a false impression. As yet, he can only appropriate things by personal enjoyment. He can only judge of their fitness or unfitness by their outward effects. Compare a plain, rustic meal, preceded by exercise, seasoned by hunger, freedom, and delight, with this magnificent but tedious repast. This will suffice to make him realize that he has got no real advantage from the splendor of the feast, that his stomach was as well satisfied when he left the table of the peasant as when he left the table of the banker. From neither had he gained anything he could really call his own. Just fancy what a tutor might say to him on such an occasion. Consider the two dinners and decide for yourself which gave you most pleasure, which seemed the merriest, at which did you eat and drink most heartily, which was the least tedious and required least change of courses. Yet note the difference. This black bread you so enjoy is made from the peasant's own harvest. His wine is dark in colour and of common kind, but wholesome and refreshing. It was made in his own vineyard. The cloth is made from his own hemp, spun and woven in the winter by his wife and daughters and the maid. No hands but theirs have touched the food. His world is bounded by the nearest mill and the next market. How far did you enjoy all the produce of distant lands and the service of many people had prepared for you at the other dinner? If you did not get a better meal, what good did this wealth do you? How much of it was made for you? Had you been the master of the house, the tutor might say, it would have been still less use to you, for the anxiety of displaying your enjoyment before the eyes of others would have robbed you of it. The pains would have been yours, the pleasure theirs. End of section 17, book 3, part 3.